We have an artist experience page on Facebook where we usually put images of the things that we're talking about, but today we're changing it because the National Gallery at this show takes place has a wonderful website and a great selection of the art that we'll be talking about, and also it's a lot better photographs than I do. So we hope that you'll look at these images at the National Gallery of Art website. And you can also stream this program at TacomaRadio.org. And we're putting podcasts of this show on my website, SheilaBlake.com, and on ArtistExperience.com so that you can listen at any time. And the podcast can also be found on iTunes.
Well, good morning, everyone. Today we have a very interesting program planned. And we'll review a beautiful exhibition currently at the National Gallery in the West Wing on the ground floor. The exhibition is titled The American Pre-Raphaelites, Radical Realists. The exhibition is on till July 21st, and of course it's free, open to the public, and it's at one of our national treasures on the Mall, the National Gallery. This exhibition is important for a host of reasons, but importantly, it is a celebration of the birth of John Ruskin, who was British, and he lived from 1819 to 1900. Ruskin was an outspoken art critic and an artist of the Victorian period, and he influenced British art in the middle of the 19th century and had an effect on American art as well, and that's what this show's about. John Ruskin came at a time when there was a renaissance in England and later in America of the spiritual and scientific qualities of the natural world. A new reverence was given to the works of Raphael and those that came before him in visually depicting the natural world through close observation. In some ways, this was a rejection of the academic premises to teaching and making art in the mid-19th century. John Ruskin's ideal were a philosophy on how to see nature and how to communicate it honestly and accurately. This period of art in England was championed by John Ruskin, and with an extremely group of talented artists that were called the Pre-Raphaelites or the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, which also included poets and musicians and theater people. These artists were really accomplished, and they're one of my favorite periods of British art. Their virtuosity, like their American counterparts in this exhibition, was tremendous. The skills are inspirational for any artist. This exhibition is about creators and makers, And it kind of will take you back to school and refresh one's memory to the need of studying in observational drawing and subjects of nature. The truism of good drawing makes for good paintings that we've discussed on the air weeks ago holds true again with this exhibition. This exhibition is an important one for those who love the landscape and love looking at the natural world in their scientific or botanical illustration. In other words, close looking at natural subject. This is one of those shows where Sheila and I learned a lot, and I learned a lot, especially about these artists I never heard of, and we want to convey this to our listeners. I titled the show, How Do They Do That? It's one thing to look closely at your subject and communicate that, but these are a group of artists that created great illusions with a great sense of mastery of the materials and methods. Well, so what about this show, Sheila, and our title, How Did We Do That? How did they do that?
That's exactly what you do in that show. You get up real close and you say, how did they do that? So we wanted to talk about the Pre-Raphaelites. Who are these people, these artists? What is this name, the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood? This is a small show of about 90 paintings, and they're mostly small watercolors, that, and they look unimposing, and they could be dismissed as old-fashioned. And partway through, I realized how these paintings, some of which I've seen before, especially the ones I've seen before, have settled in my heart and held open for me a loving vision for my own painting. The British Pre-Raphaelites gave themselves this name as a challenge to the European art that developed after Raphael, which was art made in the studio. The American Pre-Raphaelites found something in Ruskin's criticism and philosophy that struck the same chords that had been developed by Emerson and Thoreau. Look closely and accurately into the forms that nature has thrown into the world. Read what is actually there, not what is in books, but read what is in the brooks and stones and render it all in all its detail. So they followed, the Americans followed the dictates of the British manifestos with maybe more dedication than the English did. And that's what this show is about, this quiet revolution that was happening in America in the 1860s at the time of the Civil War.
Well, you know, Sheila, this exhibition conjured up a lot about the learning curve for a young artist trying to figure out how to do it, whether it's in painting or drawing. When I was a student way back when, John Ruskin's seminal book titled The Elements of Drawing was considered an important work for those learning how to draw from nature, and I was one of them. I bought the book early on in college and read it several times. I remember taking it on the beach. It was stained with suntan oil. And even though it's a very difficult book to read because it's very British didactic, if I could use the word, but there's very much a lot of important information here. The book introduces you to the sound, correct, and honest representation from what your eyes see in nature and how to communicate it. It shares media techniques to use in depicting nature, and this exhibition is a wonderful example of John Ruskin's influence on these artists in America. The book, by the way, is still available, and it's very inexpensive. It's now a Dover paperback, and you can get it for a few bucks, and it's worth it. And for those of you that are drawing and painting in nature, The Elements of Drawing by John Ruskin is a great suggestion. Well, in the galleries, you know, Sheila, you kept on mentioning, oh, as I'm a landscape painting painter, and I could learn so much. And why was that?
Oh, well, mostly because, you know, the Impressionists, which, of course, I've learned a lot from, they were more generalists. They were really interested in the light and how the light makes form. But these artists, they got up really close and they made poetry of the accidental. Weeds, plants, rocks, fallen limbs, and the light through the leaves. We've got to start out with John Ruskin. Ruskin was the leading art critic of the Victorian era. He was also an art patron, draftsman, watercolorist, and social thinker, and a philanthropist. He was a social revolutionary. He despised capitalism and the barbarians who knew the price of everything and the value of nothing.
Go Ruskin!
Ruskin believed in the power of art to transform people who we saw more oppressed by visual illiteracy than by poor living conditions. He was also a conservationist that inspired the establishment of the National Trust and the founders of the National Parks Movement. His far-ranging interests were geology and the malignant effects of the Industrial Revolution on the atmosphere and the pollution of the environment and men's souls. What's a little confusing is that John Ruskin never visited the United States, but his ideas sparked a thought revolution. Ruskin published a five-volume book that Tom has mentioned, Modern Painting. It began as a defense of J.W.M. Turner. In Ruskin's view, Turner had developed from early, detailed documentation of nature to a later, more profound insight into natural forces and atmospheric effects. He believed that documenting nature had the highest purpose. He included lessons in painting, favoring watercolor for their luminosity and also portability. After the publication of the first volume of Modern Painters in 1843, Ruskin became aware of another avant-garde artistic movement, the critical rediscovery of the painting of the Gothic Middle Ages. He wrote about these idealist painters, especially Giotto and Fra Angelico, at the end of the second volume of Modern Painters, and he belatedly added an account of them to the third edition of the first volume in 1846. These medieval religious artists could provide, he believed, in a way in which the Dutch, French, and Italian painters of the 17th and 18th century could not, an inspiring model for the art of the modern age. It's difficult now to think of an art critic having such a profound impact on thought, but he really believed that art and architecture can change the world, and he's not the only one. The Bauhaus movement was certainly successful, and also think about the planned communities that began in the 1830s. The American Pre-Raphaelites formed a brotherhood, and I think it's important, especially now, 200 years after Ruskin's birth, to see how prescient his ideas were and how these artists brought a vision that we must revere and keep. This was at a time before art became about art. Ruskin urged painters to go out of the studio and paint what they observed. He told travelers to always carry a sketchbook so they can really fine-tune their powers of observation, that religion and nature were inextricably intertwined. I think that religion, no matter how you define it, leads to the expansion of the mind from the mundane to a higher awareness, that a twig can be as infinite as a tree, that a boulder can be as awesome as a mountain or a flower. There's a seminal work in this exhibit of Ruskin's Fragments of the Alps, which is a tirelessly observed painting of a huge boulder against and above a forest of pines and the blue darkening sky. The boulder is full of the life of its creation. It has immense weight, but also seems alive. And then there's another painting, a twig of a peach bloom that is reverent in its modest simplicity. Ruskin's manifesto was widely read in England and America, and it directed young artists to be humble and earnest in encountering nature and tracing the finger of God. They should go to nature in all singleness of heart and walk with her laboriously and trustingly, having no instruction, rejecting nothing, selecting nothing, and scorning nothing, and rejoicing always in the truth. He was a master of observed detail. Ruskin's influence in America extended to painters who read the modern painters, William James Stillman and Asher Brown Durand, and his dedication to watercolor launched the practice of watercolor painting in America. And yet the artist John Brett, another artist, he seemed to follow Ruskin's instructions to the letter. And when he showed his painting to Ruskin, Ruskin was horrified when he saw Brett's painting of the valley in the Alps. He saw it as without fear, without awe, and without love. He had encouraged artists to study the world with a scientist's eye, but he also forgot to say, you better love it. He also challenged the dramatic landscapes of Thomas Cole and all the Hudson River School painters as being too fantastical and untrue to nature, which they were. But of course, no matter how accurate an artist thinks he's being, he's always interpreting, inventing, selecting. There's no other conclusion to make about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's another thing about this exhibition, I think, for artists that to see is that the natural world is represented beautifully through a variety of mediums. There's drawings and graphite, there's pen and ink, the paintings in transparent watercolor, there's gouache, which is opaque watercolor, oils, and even some mixed media pieces. The variety of communicating the natural subject in various sizes and scales are impressive as well. Some of the subjects are drawn or painted in the same size or scale as the actual object. This is called drawing something one-to-one, and it could be botanical material, eggs, nests, or birds. There are 90 works in this exhibition, and many of them really capture the nuances of the subjects, forms, patterns, and textures of the subject very, very well. And that's the real impact of this exhibition. I need to point out that there's another aspect of the exhibition which concerns itself with the practice of art and its context into the political arena at the time of the Civil War in the U.S. The Civil War and post-Civil War were a volatile period for all of the U.S., but the artist tried to incorporate some subtle symbolic meanings into these landscapes in the exhibition. Like their British Pre-Raphaelite brethren, there are many undertones to the British works that were political, religious, and socio-political as well. There was a lot more drama associated with those British artists in the Pre-Raphaelite movement. Sheila and I wanted to concentrate on the wonderful illusions that are really exquisitely done. The political subject drama will not be discussed, as this aspect of the exhibition is secondary, and the beauty conveyed in these works by these relatively unknown British and American artists are quite strong.
There are some works in this exhibit that are so dear to me. They're either paintings that I've seen before, or places that I remember, or places that are only in my dreams. For me, it's returning to past loves, and these works are no longer irrelevant or old-fashioned, but I guess the word poignant as ever. Ruskin's preferred motifs feature prominently in these drawings and watercolors: large boulders, rock-strewn landscapes showing evidence of erosion, close-up studies of plants growing in their natural environment, and blooms framed against the sky. That's something we can all immerse ourselves in. Forget about the selfies. Leave the air conditioning. Go out of your door in the morning and look up and breathe.
Oh, wow, Sheila. You're hitting us between the eyes with that one.
What does art have to do with our regular lives? Sometimes I don't know. Sometimes I can think that it's irrelevant. A lot of people practice art, especially in retirement, because it's congenial and relaxing, and there's a satisfaction in bringing home something that's pretty to go on the wall. But to me, that's not what art is about. To me, art isn't just something to decorate with. It's to expand your emotions and your mind. Truly terrific abstraction can expand your mind, and so can these modest paintings. One of my favorite paintings in the show is a small work by Charles Herbert Moore called High Peak and Round Top, Catskill in Winter. At this time, critics were considered superior to the artist. The artist can affirm but cannot reason. That's what Ruskin thought. The critic's duty was to educate the American public about ancient and modern art and to encourage discerning taste. Russell Sturgis Jr., a member of the association and an architect and critic, said, "We must all think more about art because art will give us much that is worth thinking about." So that's where the idea came from, that art critics are the brains behind the art. And the artist is the poor schmuck that makes the pictures.
All right, hold on, Miss Sheila. You're getting out of control.
That's what he's saying. Thomas Charles Farrar was a disciple of Ruskin, and he came to the U.S. and convened a meeting of the Association for the Advancement for Truth in Art in his Waverly Place studio. They had a publication called The New Path. The idea was to rebut the Hudson River School's grandiose paintings of Thomas Cole. There was a new idea to contemplate a tree or a weed as the greatest gift of nature. There was very much a purpose of building a reverence for the natural landscape as it is, and also building an American art. That's something to really think about. That's what they were thinking about, is what American art is and could be. The wildness and beauty and hope of America, independent of the old world. So after the Civil War, America completely changed. The messages that art could deliver was no longer useful, and certainly not as necessary as the revolutions in politics. The message waned and the artists scattered. Some pursued careers as watercolorists, became portrait painters, designers, and produced beautiful books. The last room in the exhibit was the work of Henry Robert Newman. These works look flatter and larger and are much more decorative. They also lose the sense of life and the presence of the divine in nature. In fact, they look like travel posters. I wasn't even going to mention this room in the exhibition, but it is exactly what happened when the ideas of the Brotherhood lost their power.
Well, except for this last room that Sheila just mentioned, many of the works in the exhibition are obvious homages to the great British Pre-Raphaelite painters like John Everett Millais, William Holman Hunt, Edward Burne-Jones, and Ford Madox Brown. These British artists had the sexiest three-word names I've ever known, and some of them were hyphenated and some not. That's a tip for the sexy Pre-Raphaelites. Like some of the American works in the exhibition, they're a bit dramatic, possibly nostalgic, and certainly embedded in a moralistic code of British society at the time. The works are a bit staged, theatrical, and sometimes schmaltzy. But something to be said about the British Pre-Raphaelites, they really can paint and they really can draw. Some of those works touch on the vulnerability and emotionality of women, a common theme in Victorian England. Works like Mon Brave in the exhibition by William John Hennessy is an homage to the great Pre-Raphaelite painter Edward Burne-Jones and his model Elizabeth Siddal. Note, one of the most famous models in the history of art. Note the gorgeous golden flow of her hair in this very strange work of a woman kissing a mirror. And then there's Gone, Gone, which is another sappy work reminiscent of the British Pre-Raphaelites. Thomas Charles Farr is very well represented in this exhibition. He was a British artist that settled in America. And these works reflect a lot of the works of John Everett Millais, the great Pre-Raphaelite British painter. Other works like On Whitehood, the Coast of Maine from 1875 by Henry Farrar, seems to be a tribute to William Holman Hunt, another great Pre-Raphaelite painter from England. Two works by John William Hill titled Grapes from 1864 were very reminiscent of William Morris, the great British designer and late Pre-Raphaelite himself. The pattern and quality of the paintings look like wallpaper by this artist, John Hill, and it's a typical like wallpaper study that you would see in the Victorian period. These obvious works that reflect the relationship of both American and British Pre-Raphaelites are the least powerful in the exhibit. The skills are there and the look is there, but the observational drawing and painting in this exhibit are the meat and potatoes of this show. Well, what about these immediate loves that you seem to have? You got very excited in some of these rooms, Sheila. I was getting a little nervous. But what about these immediate loves in the exhibition you seem to express?
Well, sadly, my first love was not in this exhibit. I think it's John Lafarge, and I think it's because he was not a official member of the Brotherhood, even though he completely subscribed to their work, and he went out into the, you know, got his feet wet in the water and painted, and the watercolors are fantastic.
Oh, they're amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Oh, I
amazing
love
artists.
His work.
Yeah.
He went on to do stained glass windows and some other more decorative work, but a painting that he did of a dogwood and a water lily. It's a pink dogwood, a white water lily. It is like exquisite. So that's one of my very first loves. So I have to mention it.
And he stood you up in the exhibition.
He stood me up in the exhibition. And then there's the artist William Trost Richards, who I'm going to talk about in a little while. And my third love are really good brushes and the materials to work with.
And they had to have good brushes for those little paintings.
Oh, my God. You just have to imagine. Really, that's true. And the other equally thrilling thing, which is what Tom is talking about, is how did they do it? There are three paintings in the show that I've loved since I first saw them over 40 years ago. I don't care how romantic Bird's Nest and Dog Roses is. It's so sweet, so alive and vibrant. It made me wonder if these paintings are being relegated to the past because artists nowadays simply have rejected them because they haven't acquired the skill and the poetic vision to do anything close to that.
I think you're right.
You really do?
I think we don't have to take the time to observe and look as closely as these other artists did. They had a patience that we don't have in this contemporary life.
Yeah. The combination of John William Hill's Bluebird's Eggs in Their Nest with the white flowers and the yellow centers and a few red berries strewn on the ground are perfection. There's a painting by Martin Johnson Heed of an orchid and three hummingbirds. I know it looks, Tom, it is schmaltzy, but they look as if they've been discovered in the wilderness. They're fresh and shyly alive in the mist. And there's a third painting that's not, and then I was also going to say the watercolor by John Lafarge. But when I think of the word exquisite, I think of these paintings.
I think that's appropriate, for sure.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then how did they do it technically? First of all, as Tom said, these artists drew beautifully. Nothing is generalized. The compositions are certainly composed, but with a love for nature. And then, as anyone who draws can tell you, nothing in nature stays the same. We've talked about this before, how the light shifts, the blossoms fall and die, the eggs hatch. We know this. So it makes the moment that these exist in all the more precious. And you can imagine that there were many preparatory sketches and with such tenderness. And again, they're really good brushes. A good number 6 watercolor brush could cost you $70. But you don't need many brushes, maybe 6 or 7. And watercolors brushes are much easier to clean and take care of.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning the watercolor brushes and also the cost. Of course, nowadays we have a lot of variety of watercolor brushes with synthetic hairs and natural hairs. But yeah, to do these works, these artists definitely had an array of wonderfully pointed brushes. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a station break now. And we wanted to pick a little more rock and roll, but I don't know if we were successful here because certainly there was a lot of rocks in that exhibition. I mean, some amazing painting of rocks and like John Ruskin's fabulous Fragment in the Alps from 1854. He brought that rock alive. And there's a mixed media works of watercolor, gouache, and graphite pencils that colorfully illustrate the mass of beautiful rocks in the exhibition. And rocks are very complex forms. I don't think most people understand that. And they have a lot of color as well. And there's boulders and rocks of all varieties by many artists in this exhibition. But while we're taking our musical break, go to the website and see how you can constructively contribute to this great community radio station, because WOWD is like a rock in the community, right? It's like we are solid as a rock. And go on to TacomaRadio.org and see the fabulous program schedule and the diverse kinds of programming we provide. Donate while you're on the web and be part of this growing radio phenomenon at Tacoma Park. Listen up.
Some real a state here in my bag. So we bought a pack of cigarettes, and this is Wagner Pies, and walked off to look for America. Kathy, I said as we boarded a Greyhound in Pittsburgh, Michigan seems like a dream to me now. It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. I've come to look for America. Laughing on the bus, playing games with the faces. She said the man in the gabardine suit was a spy. I said be careful, his bow tie is really a camera. Toss me a cigarette, I think there's one in my raincoat. Last 1 hour ago, so I looked at the scenery. She read her magazine, and the moon rose over an open field. Kathy, I'm lost, I said, though I knew she was sleeping.
Welcome back. You're listening to WOWDLP Tacoma Park. Before the break, we were talking about my loves. So here's my love, Peter, to read a poem by William Butler Yeats.
Thank you, Sheila. So I've been to the exhibition twice. Maybe I stand in for all of you appreciators of art who are not professional artists. What did I see there? I saw a dream of happiness. That's what most painting is. This dream, however, looked like the lakes and mountains of New England, where many of us vacation. Not like those gorgeous dramatic vistas of Cole and Church, but actually what it looks like to be standing on the wooded shore of a lake in the Adirondacks or the White Mountains near Mount Chicaroa or the shore of Maine. Total realism. What it actually looks like on a day when you have the freedom to just gaze at a vine or a fern and see them growing. And I thought, who bought these paintings? People who lived in 1865 in Boston or Philadelphia and dreamed of being there, away from the streets and brick and whatever city life was like then during the Civil War. And it reminded me of this dream of escape, this poem, which has beguiled college undergraduates for over 100 years. The Lake Isle of Innisfree by William Butler Yeats. I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows and a will I have there, a hive for the honeybee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow dropping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings. There, midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. While I stand on the roadway or on the pavement's gray, I hear it in the deep heart's core.
Well, thank you, Peter. Wow, what a beautiful poem, and the visual quality of it is amazing, and it's a great addition to the sentiment of the art in this exhibition in our program today. Well, a quirky thing about this exhibition are the names of the artists, as they all seem how related to each other in a host of combinations. There are lots of Farrars in the show, and Hills. There seems to be a combination of fathers and brothers and sons, and it's extremely confusing who did what. And they're also visually related. This is the first time we've encountered this in any of our programs to date. It's not really the names that are too important, but it is a quirky thing. It's the art on the walls that one should concentrate on, as many of these artists I have actually never heard of, so I learned a lot as well. Again, we titled the show, How Did They Do That? Sheila and I will take you to some of these works now in the galleries and explain their brilliance and hopefully answer that question. It's very exciting when you can find a soulmate in the exhibition or a mentor. Sheila, your second love, as you mentioned already on the program, is William Trost Richards. What about this artist and his work and drawings and paintings that impressed you? Because this artist can really put it down beautifully.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I love to talk about it. There are some beautiful works. You've got to see them to believe them, really. First, there's a graphite drawing of called A Corner of the Woods, and it's photographic in its detail, but it's poetic in its vision. And the way the light organizes the composition of the trees, the paintings of walking into the woods, they're unbelievable. That bark that he could paint, someone trained to identify the species of trees could identify each tree looking at the bark. It's so tedious to paint bark, and it's so hard to find the seemingly random patterns in nature. When you're actually drawing bark, our eyes, whether we know it or not, are acutely attuned to what's familiar, and so a repetitive pattern of bark will look unnatural or stilted, and no pattern will look careless or chaotic. So you have to just hit that exactly right place between randomness and discovery.
Well, I think any student of drawing, this one drawing by William Trost Richards is the exhibit in itself. It's a whole drawing lesson.
It
on
is.
How to see space, individuality, and close looking. And it's a marvel of And I think it's hats off to John Ruskin, because it's totally out of John Ruskin's playbook.
Uh-huh. Mm. And so when Tom and I were looking at it, I wondered about cameras, for all the reasons I always do wonder about cameras. And cameras were now in possession of many of these artists, and how they got the perfect composition, the sequence of light and dark. And that brought me to the work of William James Stillman. Stillman joined the Association for the Advancement of Truth in Art, and he made an unusual link with photography. This is really, to me, an important thought. When photography was announced to the world in 1839, it sparked debates about whether it should be considered a technical, scientific instrument or a potential vehicle for artistic expression. It posed an inherent challenge to art making, and the work of the artist was dramatically changed by this simultaneous emergence of Ruskin's call for truth to nature and the acknowledged capacity of photography to record the observable world. And as it turned out, and it has turned out in the 180 years since that, there's a back and forth between draftsmanship and the photographer. Stillman said that he couldn't paint from a photograph, but he took photographs and he brought the philosophical and spiritual sensibility to the practice of photography. He himself suffered from depression and he found relief in the Adirondacks and took many wonderful photographs. He found ways to use the properties of the camera to create new compositions that depend on the height of the lens and the microscopic vision and the dizzying effects of the sense of full immersion in the woods. The camera not only gave artists new ways to see, but they also showed them the limitations. And when I look at these photographs and the paintings, it's apparent that the compositions, like Corner of the Woods, were done with photographs and also compositionally arranged for the grace and cohesiveness and gesture that only the artist can bring to nature.
Well, the Stillman painting and the exhibition, which is put next to the photos, are like the equivalent of a fantastic painting, much like the William Trost Richards drawing is. They're a wonderful relationship in color and in black and white. There are a few drawings in the exhibition that hark at the technical mastery of pen and ink at depicting natural subject, and one of them is John Henry Hill's Thrush Nest from 1866. Is a magnificent pen and ink, and it's drawn one-to-one probably, meaning that he drew it the same size as the subject, and it's very small. It's small but powerful. Additionally, there's an unfinished work of a pine tree from 1868 by Charles Herbert Moore, a fantastic painter that's also later in the exhibition in paint. And this work harks on that close study, a very difficult subject. And this is a pen and ink drawing of a pine tree, like the needles are down, like just right. And Ruskin would be proud of that effort. But I've got to talk about Fidelia Bridges, a woman artist that I had never heard of as an American Pre-Raphaelite. I investigated her life, and it was one amazing life. I mean, this woman is really out there. Women artists at that time in America weren't many around that were getting any kind of recognition, and she deserved it. She's one of the standouts in the exhibition, and there's several of her works that to marvel at. Her story is remarkable, and the artistic point of view is as well. She was a survivor, and she succeeded in establishing herself in the art world. Three works titled Peach Blossoms, Milkweeds, and Calla Lily are done with amazing sensitivity, delicacy, and craft. And they're on one wall by themselves, and they deserve that special place by themselves. The attention to color and edges are the true illusions of the plant, and the spaces that the plants are in are remarkable. Her gift is in watercolor and possibly gouache. Her oil paintings in the exhibition are a bit stiff and unresolved, but her watercolor works are one of the most outstanding in the show. And Wisteria on a Wall, which is another terrific work that appears later in the exhibition.
I mentioned before a painting by Charles Herbert Moore entitled High Peak and Round Top in the Catskills. I don't know if I've seen this painting before or seen the place, but in my memory, I can feel the snow. I was looking out of a car window. My parents used to drive us sometimes to the Catskills, and I feel like we parked the car and I'm looking down into a valley of houses, and the houses are very modest, and there's a road leading eventually to some smooth mountains with a cold, cloudy sky, and I can just feel the cold. And yet it makes me want to get out of the car and run down that hill into that valley. It's such a small painting of nothing special, and it's so evocative. There's an American flag on the pole. This is America. It doesn't look like anywhere else.
Well, there are actually three paintings on that one wall by Charles Herbert Moore. And another artist I actually never heard of, which is kind of a little surprising to me at this point in my life. But these are really intimate works, and they're small in scale, and they're extraordinarily detailed. One of them is titled Autumn Landscape from 1865 to 1868. These works are done with the tiniest of brushes and almost a stipple technique, which are minuscule tiny dots of oil paint. There are no traces of brush marks at all in this work. The artist calls it heaven's light that captured these wintry landscapes in New York State. The color harmonies in these works, again, create a unity of forms and space to create a true, incredible natural illusion. These works are so scale, but yet so powerful, and the illusion really works. Mount Tom by Thomas Charles Ferrer from 1865 is an oil on canvas, which is another incredible, believable illusion from nature. It's a masterpiece in the exhibition and one of the highlights. The person on the lake fishing seems incidental to me and not even necessarily needed in this terrific painting. The distant mountain and sky and the reflection on the lake are a visual unison to each other as nature intended it. The belief of this illusion is so real, and yet it's not exactly photographic, but it's very real.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a show of 90 works, I automatically avoid anything that has a pale rose, a weaving woman, and pretty much all the flat, predictable landscapes of John William Hill, of which there are quite a few. There are a lot of dead birds, especially one soft dead blue jay and two pineapples, which are amazingly well done, but two pineapples lying side by side?
Yeah, it was a little staged. That one was the most staged painting.
Maybe they're staged in for voluptuous women. I don't know. And then there are two terrific paintings by John William Hill. And one is an apple blossom. And one of my very favorites that I mentioned before is Bird's Nest and Dog Roses. But most of these landscapes make me tired with all that detail and all that subdued color. It's kind of hard to put these works together with the same guy. But it looks like he got better in those few years. His compositions got more risky. His colors got more vibrant. There's a nice one of Apples and Plums, also by John William Hill. The main thing that happened to these architects, because after the war, when they became really kind of not relevant, is that William Morris and Charles Faulkner joined together with the architects to form a pioneering enterprise in the decorative arts. They created textiles, wallpaper, furniture, and stained glass, and they played a significant role in the arts and crafts movement, and even influenced the ideas of the Bauhaus. And when we look at the watercolors of John Singer Sargent, his paintings of alligators lounging in the Everglades, or his tent in the Adirondacks with the light coming through, or Winslow Homer in a hurricane in Bermuda, and Edward Hopper on Cape Cod, who do we have to thank?
Well, that's a great question. Maybe we have to go back to these American realists, mm-hmm. because they gave a foundational kind of start to what the watercolor was in America. What Sheila just mentioned is so integral at looking at things in nature. Just think about it. When you're walking in the forest, do you see one oak leaf in the forest from the oak tree, or do you see the magnificence of the whole tree next to one another, next to something else? And wham, it's a majesty of a whole forest before your eyes. When you look at a bird from a distance, do you see individual feathers, or do you see the bird in its wholeness? And these artists kind of are looking very, very closely, and you'll see feathers, and then, of course, they're looking away from the distance, and they capture both of them beautifully. Mm-hmm. These artists expertly captured the essence of nature with a compositional wholeness that is refreshing and true. The artist took you to places with astounding accuracy and honesty. For people that love to draw and paint, this exhibition titled The American Pre-Raphaelites Radical Realist is a must. The exhibition might humble you, but it should inspire you never to give up on the looking and the studying of your subject. The communication of a true landscape is complex, and it has enthralled artists for centuries. The exhibition is currently on, and it goes until July 21st. It's well worth introducing yourself to John Ruskin and his influence on British and American art, and especially the books he's written. They're really worth it. And we hope you've enjoyed the show. Now, Sheila, are we going to keep the next show a big mystery to our listeners? You seem to be on this mystery thing lately.
Yeah, I'm on a mystery tour, Tom, because you're going to be gone, and Peter and I are going to take over. And we will come up with something good. We usually do. There's also a puppetry show that we're going to do in a few weeks, Tom, after you get back.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that, the art of puppetry and puppets. Mm. And there's a rich history in the world for that, so that should be very exciting. Well, stay tuned to our next exciting program on WOWDLP Tacoma Park. And, of course, we have Bobby Hill here with This Music. Experience art and the visual in everything you do. Thanks for listening, and see you in 2 weeks.
This land is yours.